if you have access to childcare, but not a safe way to get to work or a good job, or you'd face a lot of discrimination from customers, dealing with one of those constraints while those others still persist is not going to move the lever very much.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Everywhere, especially in low middle-income countries, women's labor force participation is lower than men's. There are many reasons why we should close this gap, and there are just as many reasons why it's hard to do that. Economists are constantly discovering new and important information in how financial constraints or social norms or other institutions get in the way of increasing female labor force participation. But their research is also contributing to better, more cost-effective policies to fix the problem. You won't be surprised to discover that there is a comprehensive Vox Dev Lit on this topic. Release 2 is newly published, and so I'm talking to Rachel Heath of the University of Washington, who is the Vox Dev Lit's editor, about some of the new insights in the new release and also the directions for future research. So Rachel, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Rachel, if we assume that increased female labor force participation is an aspect of economic development, it sort of comes with it, is it the overall macro trend that female labor force participation is still increasing everywhere?
Not really, actually. It's a nuanced picture, as you might guess. It depends on which part of the world. But I think I'd broadly say, if we take a medium-term approach, so say the last 30 years, that in most parts of the world, we'd say female labor force participation has stagnated, even slightly decreased. Now, Latin America is a notable exception, so we don't want to ignore that progress. That's been an important bright spot for women in the labor force. And so that's one thing we talk about in this Vox Dev Lit. But I also wanted to bring up, there's some very recent evidence that possibly things are on the uptick. It's so hard because if we look at the last 5 years, it's COVID disrupted data collection, upended labor markets. And so it's really hard to tell, but there might be a little glimmer of optimism that some of the trends coming out of COVID, there's some evidence in high income countries that work from home has led to women entering or staying in the labor force after children. And so I think it will be really interesting to see if that continues.
The picture that we have at the moment, where that labor force participation is stalled, does this have an effect on women's empowerment if there are not more women working outside the home?
Yes, for sure it does. That there is really good evidence that we have that working outside the home is really good for women in a variety of different outcomes. And as you mentioned, empowerment is one of those, so that women have more say in household decisions when they work outside of the home. They control their own income, and that seems important. It's not just working itself. Even job opportunities are important, that women feel like even if they could work, that gives them more leverage, I would say, in household bargaining, just knowing that if they needed to, they could go get their own income, whether that's staying in a marriage or leaving if they really needed to. Just giving them that option looks like it allows them to stand up for themselves better. It has to be a good job, just because in theory, there's jobs on paper. If women don't have a safe way to get to them or childcare or things like that, then that's not the job availability. I mean, it's jobs that they realistically could take.
As you say, Rachel, if there are opportunities for women to work, it is good for women. We could also think for policymakers that it might be instrumentally good for the economy if more women are working. Is that true? Is that an assumption I can make?
It's for sure a hard thing to know, because as you might imagine, if we compare countries across the world, some of which have very high rates of women's labor force participation and some of which have very, very low rates, these are very, very different countries. And it could be that the environment that's conducive to growth is leading women to enter the labor force, say. Or even if we compare countries with rising labor force participation to countries with falling, something's still causing that. But that said, I don't think we want to just say, well, no way to know, it's too hard. I think we do have growing small pieces of the puzzle to disentangle this really hard question of women's labor force participation and growth. And so one recent paper that we discuss in the Vox Dev Lit has data from a worldwide corporation, really detailed data on the workers at a bunch of different countries in the world. And what they find is that on average, women employees perform better than men. And that makes sense that if there's barriers to women entering the labor force, then only the really capable, the really dedicated women enter. And so that makes sense that the ones that you observe working there would be this difference. Now, that gap between the men and women gets much smaller in countries where more women are working, which again makes sense because if more women are working, there's not quite the big hurdles that you have to jump over. But what it suggests is that in the countries where only the very, very best women are working, that there's a lot of really also very good women who are not in the labor force and that getting them into the labor force would be super beneficial for productivity. So we certainly have some evidence that the pieces of the puzzle are there, bringing in high productivity workers into the labor force would happen if more women were working.
When you say pieces of the puzzle, this is something that I have heard many times in talking to your colleagues about this topic. Does that imply that if you're a policymaker and you are looking to improve female labor force participation, that you can't be looking for a silver bullet? You have to look for a range of appropriate policies.
For sure. This is one of the many cases in economics where an economist would caution that there is no silver bullet, that in countries where there are low rates of female labor force participation, there's probably many interlocking constraints. And I suspect we'll talk some more about some of those. What that can mean is that even an intervention that in some areas could be very promising, like improved access to childcare, we know in some cases that is a big constraint and is really, really important. But in other cases, if you provide more childcare, that doesn't do very much. It doesn't mean that childcare is never important. It just means that if you have access to childcare, but not a safe way to get to work or a good job, or you face a lot of discrimination from customers, dealing with one of those constraints while those others still persist is not going to move the lever very much.
Okay, Rachel, let's have a look at some of the research that's covered in the Vox Dev Lit. Now, one of the big stories that is actually sort of cutting through into more general news, not just in economics or development economics, is declining fertility around the world. If women are having fewer children, does this automatically increase female labor supply?
I'm going to start sounding like a bit of a broken record when I keep saying it's context specific. But yes, the answer is sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And we talk about childcare constraints, which is the other side of the coin to fertility. Sure. And so, of course, children make it more challenging to work. Almost all working parents would agree with that. So yes, falling fertility is going to increase labor supply. But other times, it just looks like it doesn't. And that could be because there's a really strong social norm against women working. Even a woman that only has one or two kids would still be constrained by that social norm. The other thing is that, as I mentioned, childcare can be very important, but in low-income countries, there's often extended family arrangements that can be effective too. So I have a paper myself that I've written that looked at women in Ghana, urban Ghana, after they had children. And some women did drop out of the labor force, and we understand why that's the case. But the ones that stayed in were actually working more. I double and triple checked that finding to make sure because it was so surprising to me. But in retrospect, it makes sense because children take time, but they also take money. And so you need to work to provide for them. And if you have an extended family that can care for the kid or you can take your kid to work, then maybe you plausibly are working more. So all of this is to say that in these kind of complex arrangements for handling children, that sometimes the constraint to working is having another child and other times it's not.
What do we know about the relationship between access to contraception, family planning, and female labor supply?
Kind of relatedly, sometimes it looks like it does increase women's labor supply. And When it does, I'd say that it looks like kind of a key time is delaying the first birth. And so if a woman has children later, she's more likely to have a stable job or an attachment to the labor force when she has children. And so she's more likely to continue working even after children. So sometimes it looks like that's important. Other times it looks like that's not really the constraint, is that when women get access to contraception, there aren't big labor supply effects.
Several times on Vox Dev Talks, we have covered childcare provision and the impact of childcare provision on female labor supply and on many other aspects of the family as well. The sort of mental model that we have of this is the government opening nurseries or something like that. Now, it's an expensive intervention if that happens. Are we learning more about how childcare can be provided at scale in a cost-effective way that makes these policies more realistic?
Yeah, there are a couple promising recent randomized controlled trials on providing childcare. Of course, you know, the first set of randomized controlled trials, we need to see how they would scale up. But certainly, I think there's some promise as far as cost effectiveness, which make it certainly more cost effective to scale up. One that we talk about was in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And the interesting thing there was that villages opened new childcare centers. So this wasn't about adding children to existing centers or subsidizing those, not that that can't be effective as well, but these kind of really created childcare centers in communities that hadn't had them. And so they recruited local women that were relatively educated, but they're rural areas. So we're not talking about bringing in people from the capital city or anything. These were kind of local women. That did lead to increases in women's labor supply. Even though I said earlier that we know that the extended family setting in low-income countries does do a lot of childcare. The counterpoint to that is the fact that this RCT did have effects, suggests that that's not sufficient for everybody. So childcare is still an important piece of the puzzle, and that you can design childcare in a way that's not always terribly expensive and that could potentially scale up, even if we haven't gotten empirical evidence on the scale. And I'll just mention briefly, there was another similar program in Burkina Faso that integrated childcare into the public works job guarantee program there so that you could work for there and bring your kid to the childcare. And that was also effective at increasing women's labor supply. So that's kind of another model that looks like it has some promise.
Another important piece of this puzzle is the male attitude towards women working. I note in version 2 of the Vox Dev Lit, you have a lot of coverage of male backlash against women's empowerment, which means that they would wish to go out to work. How does this male backlash, how does it manifest? What can be done to change that?
It could manifest in several different ways. In the revision to the Vox Dev piece, we cite a very recent paper that looked at a very interesting setting. So this was the lifting of the ban on women driving in Saudi Arabia.
For the first time ever, women in Saudi Arabia will be able to hit the road as drivers. They've finally been granted the right after decades of protest.
After more than 20 years of campaigning in the ultra-conservative Islamic nation, they finally won the right to drive.
My reaction is I'm on cloud nine. I'm very, very happy, excited.
On average, it increased women's employment, but it mattered crucially what the women's family situation was. So women that were single, you know, they were more likely to work after the researchers gave the women driving lessons. So the whole country, women were allowed to drive, but there were very few spots in driving school. And so the researchers could create random variation in women that actually could drive by randomizing their attendance at the school. And so for the single women that got this, this was great for them. They were more likely to work. But women that were married or even co-parenting with a man, they weren't more likely to work, and they actually had reduced autonomy over the spending that they could make. The researchers interpret this as evidence of backlash, that the women had this kind of newfound potential, but they weren't using it, and the husbands were actually counteracting that to try to rein in the women's independence. It's a very strategic behavior on the part of the husbands. In other circumstances, we see it manifest in more heated ways, not coldly rational. So unfortunately, we do see that sometimes, whether it's working outside the home or just other forms of women's empowerment, job training or things like that, we unfortunately see that that can lead to increased intimate partner violence. Not always, I should be clear that that's not a universal finding, but we do see pockets of backlash there too. We want to be very attentive to that. We also don't want to go too far the other extreme and stop trying to empower women because there could be backlash. And so that brings me to the next part of your question about, is there anything we can do about this? There's a lot of ongoing work, so we should know much more soon about how to change men's attitudes. And so there are different forms of programs to discuss norms with men, to engage them in, if it's a training program for women, to engage men in that. We're starting to see some of those that can work. I think over the next few years, we'll see more about if we can try to make some patterns about what kinds of programs are effective. To give a short example from my own research in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, we did a women's training program and stipend, so trying to economically empower women. And some of their husbands were involved in the men's engagement program that brought the men in. We thought about it a little bit like couples counseling component. There was a trained facilitator that involved them in conversations. While it was going on, that led to less intimate partner violence, which is, again, something that we really look for in the context of a program that's empowering women. But the effects didn't persist after the program ended. So the women's economic empowerment persisted. And that was a big lesson of that experiment, that even a year after they stopped getting the stipend and the training had ended, the women were earning more. And that was great. But the reduction in intimate partner violence was short term. In that case, it really looked like you needed the ongoing facilitation of these conversations. Of course, people are going to keep looking for, are there ways we can change norms around masculinity in ways that would be persistent? Because I think that's the thing that would be the best possible outcome. And people are looking at things like edutainment. If you have a very popular soap opera that shows a different kind of masculinity, and that has this norm piece where if everybody's watching it and discussing it, you could really maybe change the norms, not just at the individual level. So we, again, will hopefully have more evidence on that very soon as well.
Yes, we covered edutainment quite recently, and it was absolutely fascinating to find out how this is now being harnessed and how it can be used and how economists can work to be able to find out how effective edutainment is. There's one other piece of research that I have noticed recently. That is the way in which norms become hard to change because perhaps men think that other men disapprove of women working when they maybe don't, and the other men don't as well, but it makes norms very sticky. Is this something that you have seen as a factor in your research?
If there's a misperception about how other people, other men in particular, feel about women's work, that could be an additional barrier. As far as how sticky it is a good question. There's a experiment a couple years ago, also in Saudi Arabia, that corrected these beliefs and said to men, hey, did you actually know that X percent of men in your area are supportive of women working outside the home? Mm-hmm. And that led to women having additional interest in working. So it's one of those where you'd love to see longer term effects of that. Was that correction enough to persist longer term? There was some promising initial results. We also have evidence that when factors come in that have led to more women entering the labor force, we have seen norms around women changing as part of that. So there's just a sense that the more you see women working around you, that can change those norms as well. It's certainly a potential additional benefit to raising these other barriers, as it could also start to change the norms as well.
Maybe we're talking too much about men. Let's talk about policies that directly affect women. And particularly, I'm interested in psychological interventions that have been done to raise aspirations for women, to treat depression for women. How effective have they been?
We do find some evidence that psychological interventions can be effective. And as you mentioned, things like interventions to raise your aspirations, visualize the future, just have an additional feeling of self-efficacy. Those can be effective at increasing women's labor supply. They're definitely a potential tool in the toolkit, whether alone or as part of other trainings. I think where the evidence gets a little more mixed is when we get to the level of mental illness or clinical mental illness. So things like serious depression. Obviously, therapy can be important for dealing with mental illness, but the evidence on whether that increases women's labor supply is more mixed. And I think that's not necessarily surprising. We know the levels of depression and other forms of mental illness in low-income countries are sadly very high and debilitating. And so it's possible that accessing therapy or other interventions for depression could really be important for improving your quality of life and your health. But at that level of such severe illness, it might not be enough to get you into the labor force, especially if you're dealing with all these issues around social norms and things like that.
What can we do to protect working women from harassment or violence because they have to commute to work and they're working outside the home? Are there policies to ensure that women are safer when they're working?
We do spend a lot of time in this VoxDev piece, first just documenting how costly it is for different aspects of women's working lives that they face violence and harassment in public. So starting even with educational choices, women are less likely to do well in school if they face violence. There's a great study by one of our deputy editors that found that women in India choose colleges that aren't as prestigious as they would otherwise if there's a safer route to them.
Gosh,
we kind of know going in that it's a problem. Then, of course, the question is, what do we do? So there has been some great new evidence on public transit in particular. A very cool experiment in Hyderabad, India. They actually worked with the police department to randomize policing of hotspots where they knew that gender-based violence on public transportation was problematic. And they even randomized, was the police officer plain clothed or visible? And they find that the visibility does matter. One of the most interesting parts, they also surveyed the police officers on their attitudes on gender issues. And it really matters whether the police officer had tolerance of these violence or whether they were so-called more progressive as far as really wanting to stop it. So it's suggesting police matters, but also who those police officers matter. A real open question, we know that women face lots of violence in the workplace as well. And that's harder to get evidence on because you have to really dig into the workplace. From the little piece of evidence we have from a high-income country setting is that women managers are more likely to fire perpetrators of sexual harassment and that getting women into the management level matters. But I think it's a huge open question that we hope to see more research on. It's great to get women safely to the workplace, but they're going to spend most of the day in the workplace. And so how can we make those workplaces safer?
Now, one of the fascinating aspects of this VoxDevlet that you bring out is the insight that if women need to rely on childcare provision or the sorts of jobs which would accommodate their working hours or their needs or those safe commutes that you were talking about, it means that they don't have many options to switch jobs, and that has an effect on their working lives. How important is this?
That's very important. Another one of our deputy editors had a great study from Brazil where she knows the types of firms women are working in and can identify plausible cuts to the firm's revenue and sees that when firms are less profitable and some of that goes to the workers, so the jobs become less lucrative, women are much less likely to leave than men. So they are stuck in these jobs. That is a significant contributor to men earning more than women, is that men can leave in search of a higher paying job. As you mentioned, Tim, some of this is that women are more constrained in their commutes. They need to make sure that the commutes are safe. And the other is, as you also mentioned, that some employers are more friendly in other ways to women as well, and women are less likely to leave those jobs. So it looked like both are contributors to the women staying in the jobs, but they did have substantive effects on women's wages.
Okay, Rachel, let's just talk about some opportunities for future research. I mean, there's clearly a lot of opportunity for future research. As we've been talking, there are so many barriers to female labor force participation. What do we need to learn about their relative contribution of these constraints in different contexts? How those constraints interact?
There is more, of course, that we can learn just on these barriers side. So we documented a lot of these in our report, but there's a question of extrapolation. Sometimes you learn something in one setting and we have some evidence from a higher middle income country. Would it translate to a low income country? I think is one thing. And then how these barriers interact is still an open question. What are the characteristics of areas that say when we provide contraception to women that doesn't lead to increased women's labor supply, what are the biggest constraints? I nodded to some as far as, you know, availability of good jobs, social norms against women's working. But I think they haven't really been quantified because, you know, even though I made earlier an argument for moving multiple constraints at once, realistically, we understand that you can't always do an 8-part big push to increase women's labor supply. So I think a big open question is, if we can pair one thing with contraception or childcare availability, what would be it? And so I think that's one area for the research to go.
Of course, a huge policy story this year has been the changes in the global economy and how that has changed globalization. Now, there are many places in the world where globalization has increased female labor force participation. You know, Bangladesh is an obvious example. We're going to be finding out more about how these changes in the global economy are affecting the opportunities for women to work?
Certainly, people will be watching that as it goes. There's a potentially unprecedented change for suppliers that export to the U.S. in tariffs, but there's always been lots of external factors that affect how exposed people in a given country are to globalization, commodity price shocks, things like that. From what we do know, this is yet another case where it's very context specific. So you mentioned Bangladesh, where by far the leading exports garments, and that's majority women. And that's a country where women's labor force participation could really suffer a lot, depending on what ultimately happens with tariffs. There are other countries where exporting is more based on agriculture or minerals or things like that, that are more heavily male and could be the opposite that happens. So export manufacturing is often heavily women, but not always the case. And so the gendered patterns of the tariffs will depend a lot on what is exported.
Well, it's clear from what we've been talking about that these are not easy problems to solve. It's not easy to design policies that are going to solve them. What's the incentive for policymakers to do this?
Increasing women's labor force participation can be good for growth. Certainly, that's something that policymakers care about. Women often are disadvantaged relative to men in the low-income world in particular. So if your goal is to improve the welfare of people that are worse off, jobs for women is a good way to achieve that goal. We also have some evidence that job availability leads to more investment in children, especially girls, so there can be positive feedback. Just the availability of jobs can also lead to more education, which itself has beneficial effects.
Rachel, it feels like we've talked about a million things, but we've only just scratched the surface of what's in the Vox DevLit. I think the best idea is to encourage everybody to read it. Thank you very much for talking about it today, though.
Thanks, Tim. It was great to be here.
For everyone who is going to go and read it, and I would assume that's going to be all of you, release 2 of the Vox Dev Lit on female labor force participation is available at voxdev.org. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, and the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, follow us, subscribe, wherever you get your podcasts, you will find us there. Our past episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org, where you will find, well, in this case, you will find the Vox Dev Lit that we've been talking about, but also other articles on the same topic. And if you like what you hear, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review, especially if you're going to give us a 5-star review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zalgarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.